Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. China will return the underwater drone that it took from the U.S. Navy last week in the South China Sea. The handoff will happen tomorrow in the Scarborough Shoals, about 100 miles off the coast of the Philippines. The Pentagon says the drone was carrying out routine operations, but Beijing says its presence in the South China Sea is just another example of American efforts to contain China. Stephen Nagy is a professor of international politics at the International Christian University in Tokyo, and he joins us via Skype. And Professor, first of all, seizing a U.S. drone obviously entails a great deal of risk. Why would China even do this to begin with?
Okay, I think there's a few things happening here. It has something to do with the South China Sea. And secondly, it has something to do with the incoming president of the United States, Mr. Trump, the phone call from Taiwan, as well as some of his tweet diplomacy, which he's sparked some controversy in China about what is the direction a Trump president is going to go with regards to Sino-U.S. relations going forward.
So let me see if I have this straight, that you believe that part of the reason why China seized the drone is in order to send a message to President-elect Donald Trump?
Yeah, I do feel this way. I think that China has understood that the United States has been quite active in monitoring the South China Sea, and these particular drones are used for so they can get some information how to use submarines within the region. Now, Mr. Trump has sparked controversy with his phone call with President Chai, but also his tweets indicating that he may shift his foreign policy view vis-a-vis China from a one-country China to something more ambiguous, or perhaps even thinking about Taiwan as a separate state. China would like to send a very strong signal to the incoming president that Taiwan is, it's something non-negotiable. And by stepping on the United States' toes in terms of pulling up this drone, it demonstrates that China is willing to step up its game.
Do we think that President-elect Trump got the message, though? Because the first thing he did was send out yet another tweet where he said China steals the United States Navy research drone in international waters, rips it out of the water and takes it to China. Unprecedented act.
Well, I think he got the wrong message. Beijing's signaling pattern is to demonstrate that it has the ability to disrupt the United States' capacity to function within the South China Sea. And the idea was to show that Beijing has some capacity to push back against the United States. And, of course, President-elect Trump's behavior and his attitudes to this kind of bullying, whether it was in the election or whether it's in foreign policy going forward, is to push back, to criticize, to try to mobilize a populist sentiment so that he can push forward a more aggressive and a more pro-American stance.
So, Professor Nagy, let me just ask, how delicate is this moment that we're in right now? Because, I mean, I don't recall China seizing U.S. military equipment for some time. It's quite an act.
Well, the last time was during the Bush administration when a Chinese aircraft downed an American surveillance aircraft. So it's been about 15 years. Now, why is this significant now? It's, again, I think because President-elect Trump has touched a very sensitive spot with regards to Chinese understandings of what its core interests is. And I wouldn't be surprised if they push back much harder on various other issues, whether it's repealing support for the Iran nuclear deal, repealing support for climate change, or pushing other buttons that may complicate U.S. foreign policy, not just within the region, but globally.
Hmm. Well, let's take a step back here for just a moment, because, I mean, China has been very aggressively building up its military presence in the South China Sea, has it not?
Yes. So it's in response to other countries within the region as well. We should understand that Vietnam and other countries have built artificial islands of some sort. But China, of course, in terms of scale and the militarization of islands within the South China Sea, are far and beyond other countries within the region. Just recently, they've added different kinds of anti-missile batteries to strengthen their claims on the islands. So this has disrupted and complicated U.S. relations within the region. And for the United States, it's not a territory issue. It's about the free transport and free movement of ships that transport goods for global trade, which can affect the U.S. and other economies within the region.
And finally, Professor Nagy, I mean, it's sobering enough to think that China may very forcefully push back on those other issues that you touched upon, climate change, Iran, etc. Is there any possibility that we could see an escalation in military responses?
Well, I think at this stage, China understands the risk of escalation of military conflict, and their priority is stabilization, freedom movement of ships within the South China Sea and East China Sea, and trying to bide their time until I think that they're strong enough to push back against the United States and other countries that are threatening their territorial claims.
Well, Stephen Nagy is a professor of international politics at the International Christian University in Tokyo. Many thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks as always. It's great to talk to you.
Today, for the first time and after many attempts, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to send UN monitors to eastern Aleppo to deliver humanitarian and medical aid and monitor evacuations from that city. But with that city near collapse and Russian-backed Syrian troops about to take it from rebels, one wonders if this is too late. Aleppo has become a symbol of the U.S. and the world's failure in Syria, and the finger-pointing has escalated. President Obama was asked at his press conference on Friday if he feels any moral responsibility for his approach to Syria, which the president said earlier had included not putting U.S. troops on the ground. The president said yes.
But I continue to believe that it was the right approach, given what realistically we could get done. Absent a decision, as I said, to go in a much more significant way. And that, I think, would not have been sustainable or good for the American people, because we had a whole host of other obligations that we also had to meet, wars we had already started and that were not yet finished.
President Obama also said on Friday that Russia and Iran, which backed President Assad in Syria, share blame for the dead in Aleppo. But Republicans have been saying for a year it was President Obama who lacked strength in Syria. And last week, his own Secretary of State John Kerry said that not following through on Obama's red line threat damaged U.S. credibility. Let's remind ourselves what that is with Joshua Landis, professor at the University of Oklahoma and director of the University Center for Mideast Studies. He joins us from KGOU in Norman. And Joshua, it's been, 6 years of a civil war, more than 500,000 people killed, millions displaced. When the uprising first started in 2011, remind us, what was President Obama's approach?
His approach was, and I think most Americans believed, that Assad would fall on his own, as had other leaders in the Arab Spring uprisings. And so he believed that he would be on the right side of history, as he called it, if he condemned Assad, said that Assad had to go and he should move aside. And this was part of democracy promotion in the region and being on the side of what seemed to be very broad and popular demonstrations.
Well, then in 2012, President Obama laid out what he called the red line, saying that if Syrian President Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons, the U.S. would intervene militarily. Then it became clear in August of 2013, a year later, Assad had used chemical weapons in rebel-held suburbs of Damascus. And President Obama did not intervene militarily, but there's a backstory here. What happened?
Well, he got the Russians and Assad to agree to cough up all of his chemical weapons, and he got them out of Syria. So he did uphold his red line, which was to not allow the use of chemical weapons or weapons of mass destruction in the world. He said that was a norm that needed to be maintained, and he did maintain it. So he got rid of them, and that was a blessing in a sense to the region, because had he bombed and destroyed the regime, as many of the opposition were hoping he would do, it's very possible that al-Qaeda and perhaps ISIS would have gotten their hands on this very abundant chemical weapon material, including nerve gases and so forth, that could have been used in Syria widely. Well, that didn't happen. So it was a good thing.
But while the Russians helped then, they grew increasingly empowered to help Assad in bombing in Syria. What could have happened in that moment? Because that's what his critics point to and say President Obama could have, should have done something when that became apparent.
Right. Well, you know, we're looking at this obviously in retrospect, where 500,000 people have been killed. And we think we should have done something to stop this. Now, what we could have done is destroy the Assad regime, and that we could have done quite easily. We did it to Gaddafi. We did it to Saddam Hussein. We did it in Afghanistan. We can take out regimes, especially these very brittle, not very powerful regimes that are built around dictators. The trouble is, what comes next? And that's what President Obama has always put out there and said, what would we have done to get out of Syria? Would we have made it a better place? And it would have been our responsibility to take care of all those people if massive civil war broke out. And that's been the main problem in Syria. And we see today that the Syrian opposition has over 1,000 different militias, some of which are the most powerful ones, are very right-wing, Salafist, and some of them jihadists like ISIS and Nusra, the al-Qaeda militia. So the United States has not been able to unify them. Syria remains a very fragmented nation where people have organized around clan, village, tribe. They have not united. This is not George Washington in America where they've united behind one leader and you get all the different parts of the country together.
Joshua Land is painting a much more complicated picture than those pointing fingers do. I want to pick this up with you again. This story isn't going away, so we will do that. Joshua, thank you.
Pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
During the presidential campaign, Fox News host Sean Hannity was firmly behind Donald Trump. Hannity rallied support for Trump on his conservative TV and syndicated talk radio shows, and he'll most likely continue to do so throughout Trump's presidency. Jeremy Hobson recently spoke with Brian Rosenwald about this. Rosenwald is a fellow at the Robert A. Fox Leadership Program at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's writing a book about the rise of talk radio and its influence on politics. Jeremy began by pointing out that while many people associate Sean Hannity with his Fox News show, his radio audience is much bigger, about 12.5 million weekly listeners.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that people sometimes forget in the political world is while TV might be sexier, radio can often reach more listeners, and the audiences are intensely loyal. And Sean Hannity, his background is radio. Before he was doing TV, he was doing radio in Huntsville, Alabama, and Atlanta, Georgia. And a lot of these guys who do both will tell you they like radio more. They reach more people. They have more time. They like the medium better.
And you mentioned Huntsville, Alabama, and Atlanta, Georgia. Sean Hannity is from New York State. How did he become such a force in conservative talk radio?
Well, he started out, he actually flopped on a college radio station in Santa Barbara that was way to the left, where he went out there after he dropped out of college. And he admittedly says, look, I was terrible. And then he ended up starting his sort of rise in Huntsville, Alabama. And they migrated to Atlanta, and he was doing morning drive on a talk station down there. And then he did some TV work, and Roger Ailes discovered him. And he comes to New York to do Hannity and Combs and joins the powerhouse station on WABC. And he's there for a few years. And they decide in 2001, they're looking for syndicated stars, especially conservative ones. ABC Radio decides to syndicate Hannity, and they have him set up to go in a bunch of major markets. And he has the sort of fortune to have his national debut be September 10th, 2001.
Wow.
And obviously the next day sort of changes the face of the country, and the ratings for talk radio across the board skyrocket. People want to talk about it. They want to hear what other people are saying. It becomes kind of a virtual community. And people who had never heard Sean Hannity start to hear him. They like what they're hearing. And he sort of goes from there to become the number two guy in talk radio.
And he is so trusted by his listeners. I want to just listen to one little clip here that gives you a sense of this. This is a 90-year-old caller calling into Hannity's radio show.
So what else is on your mind today? You happy about the election results?
Oh, yes. I mean, I won't go with a walker, but I insisted that I had to go down and vote, and I voted for Trump. And I'm concerned that they're trying to undermine his win with the Electoral College. I know you're going to keep on that, though.
Listen, you don't have to worry. We're going to stay on it. As a matter of fact, we're going to check in with Blaise Ingolia. He is the chairman of the Florida Electoral College and the Republican Party down there. And there's all these people now intimidating members of the Electoral College and trying to get them to switch their votes. And there's even some death threats. So I promise you, we'll stay on it, okay?
He's like an advocate for his listeners in a very direct way. How did he gain their trust?
Absolutely. I mean, and I've heard callers say, thank God you're out there, Sean. We have a voice now. You know, there are some people who spend more time with their favorite talk radio host than they do with their spouses, people who are driving a truck all day or out on a tractor or doing some other job where they can listen 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, you know, 48, 50 weeks a year to the same person. They feel like they get to know that person, and that person reflects their views. And in a lot of cases for conservatives, that person punches back at people who they feel like are maligning them and scorning them and mistreating them.
Well, Hannity did find himself at odds with some conservative Republicans by being so openly supportive of Donald Trump during the primary. How did he develop an alliance with Trump?
Well, from what I've read, they have a friendship. Hannity and Trump know each other, and that there is a certain level of trust, whereas maybe the average conservative wouldn't have had that. But we have to understand that, first of all, Sean Hannity is maybe the most kind of loyal party guy on major talk radio. He might not like me saying that, but it's true. You know, when a campaign needs something, when a Republican congressman needs, you know, to get a message out or something, people know that if they call Sean, that he's kind of on the team, on the reservation. Hmm. He was very clear, look, I'm going to support whoever wins the primary. I think the best way to get conservative policy enacted is through the Republican Party. And the worst thing that could happen to the country is Hillary Clinton. And I think to some extent he kind of saw the tea leaves and understood that Donald Trump was likely to be the nominee. He could feel the kind of energy at the ground level because he was hearing it from his callers, you know, and he wasn't going to sit there and bludgeon the guy who was going to be the person taking on Hillary Clinton. And he said during the primary in a bunch of times, look, I'm not a journalist. This is not supposed to be journalism 101 where I fire the hardest questions at him. And I guarantee you that it doesn't matter who the Republican on with me is, they're going to face softer questions and easier questions than Hillary Clinton would face. And that's who I'd really grill. And I think he also, you know, hosts have a very good finger on the pulse of their audiences. You know, the people who really saw their ratings drop over the course of the campaign were those people who never came around and were never Trump. We also have to remember, in so much as as Donald Trump was the voice of kind of the blue collar white man who felt forgotten, Sean Hannity fits that demographically. He's the son of a probation officer from Long Island who was a building contractor and a bartender. He dropped out of college. He is the sort of epitome of the kind of person in America who really Donald Trump's message really resonated with. And so we have to understand that message probably resonated with him pretty well.
Do you think that he influenced the election with his radio show and with his TV show among his audience?
I think that in the primary election, had people like Sean Hannity really been hardcore against Donald Trump from day one, you know, we're going back to 2015 here, they might have been able to knock him off in the primary. In terms of a general election, you know, people were bombarded on all sides with information. And usually I don't think talk radio has a huge influence in presidential general elections for that reason. But in this case, in so much as the key to the election, or one of the keys, was getting conservatives who had misgivings about either Trump's morals or his qualifications or some of what he said or some of the policies he supported to go out and vote for him. I think talk radio's kind of drumbeat of, you know, Hillary is worse, and attacking her and keeping her emails front and center from day one for, you know, a year and a half, that helped drive those conservatives with misgivings back onto the reservation. And this is, you know, what Hannity and other talk radio hosts do at election time, which is they frame things in such a way and they keep their audience kind of understanding the stakes and why Republicans, whatever misgivings you might have, Republicans are still the best way to go.
But now the election is over and they don't have Hillary Clinton to kick around anymore. And now we get on to policy and issues of governing. And Sean Hannity is going to have to decide whether he is going to be a full on Trump loyalist or if he's going to be more of a Republican Party loyalist if those two things diverge. I want to just listen to him on his show on December 12th, reacting to the news that the Russians were behind the hacking of the DNC and John Podesta's email accounts, which is intelligence that even Republicans John McCain and Lindsey Graham believe and have taken seriously. Here he is.
have talked to Julian Assange on air, off air, on TV, on radio, and I've watched him give other speeches. And he categorically denies any of this came from Russia. Any of it. So, you know, unless and until we can prove it, I'm just assuming this is another liberal media fake news story that they're all falling for. And it's politically motivated, as evidenced by their lack of concern about hacking and cybersecurity over the years.
Is Hannity going to always side with Trump, do you expect? Or do you think that he's going to be more of a Republican Party loyalist?
I don't think he will always side with Trump. There will be issues where he and his audience get their backs up and are very upset with something that Trump did, that because it was entirely too moderate for them. At the end of the day, when it comes time for the midterm elections or the 2020 presidential election, they're still going to say Republicans and Donald Trump, that's the way to go. But it's also important to note, you mentioned Lindsey Graham and John McCain. Well, those are people who, in the language of talk radio, are rhinos or Republicans in name only. They are insufficiently loyal and conservative as far as the talk radio audience is concerned. And I add one more point, which is that Donald Trump is kind of stylistically the candidate of talk radio. He is playing out of their playbook. He is preaching from their hymnal. They have the same understanding of how to communicate and the language that's going to draw attention and the sort of the black and white world. You're either with us or against us kind of thing. Trump kind of understands stylistically what has been so popular with the medium. You know, he was a frequent caller for several years to some talk radio programs. And he, you know, during the campaign, he talked to Hannity, felt like every day, but it was, you know, more like a few times a week. So I think Hannity is likely to be with them most of the time. And when he's not with them, it's going to be because he's insufficiently conservative on some issues that are important to Hannity and his audience.
That's Brian Rosenwald, who is an instructor and fellow at the Robert A. Fox Leadership Program at the University of Pennsylvania. He is currently working on a book about the rise of talk radio and its influence on politics. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Happy to do it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Police say a driver at a stop sign in Little Rock, Arkansas, became impatient when the car in front of him lingered too long, so he shot at the car, killing a 3-year-old. Asen King was in the back seat of his 47-year-old grandmother's car when the man in the vehicle behind them honked the horn. The grandmother didn't move fast enough. The man got out and fired. And now the search is on to find him. Isabella Moeller is with KARK Fox 16 Little Rock. Isabella, this is heartbreaking and so hard to fathom. I mean, the grandmother drove onto the mall where she was meeting family, and that's where she realized that her grandson had been shot and killed?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, going to the mall probably to do some more holiday shopping with the holidays just about a week away. Heartbreaking to open up the car and find her grandson lying there.
But is there so much gunfire that you would drive directly to a police station when someone fires a gun?
You know, she did say that she heard one shot, and that's what police are telling us. She didn't know that it was in the car. And that's why she didn't.
Yeah.
But definitely a question we're all looking for.
Right. Any indication the suspect knew the woman or the grandchild?
Right now, police are saying that they have no connection. They're calling this road rage completely and no indication of gang-related activity. So this is really just a road rage incident gone wrong.
Well, and the second one, this is incredible. Just a few weeks ago, a 2-year-old was shot and killed while she was in the back seat of her mother's car. And no one's been arrested in that either. Do police think this could be the same person?
You know, they haven't commented on that, but yeah, it wasn't but 3 weeks ago that 2-year-old Ramiah Reed, she was shot just before Thanksgiving while riding in a car with her mom. She was in her mom's arms, and she later died at the hospital. And that is another deal where there's a $20,000 reward. Speaking with pastors yesterday, they're all hoping that this money talks. But right now, it sounds like this money's not enough.
Wow. So two incidents, potentially two, but, you know, maybe one suspect. What are people there saying?
A lot of people are just in shock. Just before Thanksgiving, we had the death of 2-year-old Ramiah Reed. She passed from gunfire. And then it was just around that time in October that a 19-month-old died in Eudora, Arkansas by a drive-by shooting. So as much as we're saying this is two toddlers in Little Rock, there's another one in Arkansas, a 19-month-old that also lost her life, and another family that's grieving this holiday season.
Well, and we know Asen, the 3-year-old who was killed in that alleged road rage incident at the stop sign Saturday night, I believe. He is the 40th homicide victim this year in Little Rock.
Right.
Is that up or down? How is the, what does that reflect on the overall rate?
That is up for Little Rock. And it does have police concerned, and, you know, they are working really hard. They're really asking for the community at this point. They're all saying that, you know, we can't do this alone. We need people to speak up. The community knows more about this than we do. And, you know, talking with the pastors yesterday, they were saying those that know who did it, those that know who's responsible, they're just as much guilty as the person that pulled these triggers because they're withholding this information. They're just as much guilty as those that pulled the trigger.
That's Isabella Moeller with KARK Fox 16 Little Rock. Isabella, thank you.
Thank you.
This month, Robert Hurwitz is stepping down as president of the Nonesuch record label, a job he's held since 1984. It's hard to explain what a seismic shift this is. Nonesuch is a boutique division of the Warner Music Group, but it's punched way above its weight. It's been called an oasis of artistic excitement, and Hurwitz had a lot to do with that. He brought on the Buena Vista Social Club and Emmylou Harris.
Waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to a red dirt girls in a red.
And Bob Hurwitz nurtured the career of so many others, including Polish classical composer Henryk Gorecki. Caetano Veloso, Astro Piazzolla, Brad Meldow, Pat Metheny, The Black Keys, Bill Frisell, Katie Lang, and Brian Wilson also recorded with Nonesuch. The list goes on. Classical music composer John Adams compared Bob Hurwitz to a great book editor. Stephen Sondheim called him a master craftsman. And though he's stepping down as president, Bob Hurwitz will become chairman emeritus and continue to executive produce albums, so maybe he's just switching mountain peaks. Last December, Robert Hurwitz joined us in the studio. Wow, what a career. Head of the label, executive producer of dozens of albums, and after it was all done, the artists like you, which doesn't often happen.
Well, I like them as well.
Well, is that a part of it?
Yes. You know, people have a conception of musicians as being temperamental or self-centered. I have to say that almost without exception, there is a kind of common thread of decency amongst the community of musicians who I've worked with over the last 3 decades at Nonesuch.
Composer Steve Reich says, when you hear something you like, no matter what the genre, you sign that artist.
Well, I've always felt that I have a remarkably easy job. Sometimes what you hear in the first 20 or 30 seconds, where you're following your instincts, can be shockingly on the mark. And the idea of liking something is one of the two criteria that I've always tried to use. The other one is if it's original. So that there are things that I like, but other people are doing it, and I probably won't sign that artist. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are doing something original, but I don't like it, and I probably won't sign that artist. But the rarest thing is when you hear someone who's doing something you have never heard before, and you love it. And then it's a kind of instant reaction, almost like falling in love.
We've been listening to some Steve Reich. In its day, it was those things. It was original.
Steve is clearly one of the most important musicians of the second half of the 20th century. and along with Philip Glass, Terry Riley, and a few other people, I think changed the course of music.
What else do you do, Bob Hurwitz? You're going to continue as chairman emeritus, and you will be executive producing albums. What does that mean? I mean, does that a money function, or do you literally tell someone like a Stephen Reich or John Adams? You published his 1987 opera, Nixon in China. Do you tell them, you know, I kind of don't like this part here? What does that mean, EP?
No. With people like John and Steve, you just stay out of the way. As far as your other question, come January 2017, the thing I will not be doing is waking up every morning and having the responsibility for Nonesuch. And, you know, in this world, the music business, people are saying, has gone through all these transitions, and they say it's a very difficult business. But in fact, it's always been a difficult business. And I remember back in the early 80s when I got the job, I wrote down about 15 lines on a piece of paper. And one of those was, this job will always be difficult, and never take it for granted.
Well, but let's talk about what that means, that it's difficult to run a company. We'll listen to a little of Pat Metheny. He's been with you since an early recording, Bright Size Life. He told us in an email that you're among the last of a long line of special people in the record industry who truly earn a deeply trusted place in the hearts of musicians because of how you work with them, balancing art with industry profit. So tell us more about, you know, what does that mean to you, and tie it into it's difficult to run a record label.
One of the roles of a person like myself is balancing those worlds of art and commerce. To the people on the corporate side, it's the notion of spending their money as if it's your own money. In terms of the artist side, is respecting their art and their craft and acting in the most supportive possible manner that is going to give them the freedom to do the best work.
Yeah, it's saying to Warner Brothers, this is not going to be Justin Bieber, but it's going to be great and worth our investment. You know, it's not going to
And you have to remember that whether you're talking about Emmylou Harris or Justin Bieber, we're living in a very, very big world. You could even look at Adele, who is the biggest artist in the world today and will probably sell 15 million copies in America alone of Adele 25, which means there's probably going to be over 300 million people who won't buy the record. Mm-hmm. The world of music is incredibly vast, and there's a lot of people out there who are just like me and possibly you as well, who have an interest in something that's not part of the popular culture of that minute.
Well, your instincts have paid off because they may not be popular culture when you bet on them, but then they often become popular culture. Chris Thiele, Punch Brothers. Audra McDonald, here she is with The Stars and the Moon in 1998. Let's listen to a little bit.
I met a man who had no yearn, no claim to fame, who was content to let life pass him for a while. I was sure that all I ever wanted was a life like the movie stars led. And he kissed me right here, and he said, I'll give you stars and the moon and a soul to guide you.
Well, as we said, you're going to continue to executive produce albums. Just briefly, is there somebody out there now you're thinking, I want them, or is that the excitement? You don't know who they are yet.
Well, you don't know who they are, but you know that's one of the biggest rushes. Back in 1996, I got a call from someone named Omis Hirschbein, who was the head of the 92nd Street Y, who said, you know, I never call you about seeing things, because I know you're busy and I know you have very specific tastes, but you have to go see the show Playwrights Horizons. It's a show called Floyd Collins.
I'm ready now, Lord. I know I weren't no Sunday school mama's boy, but faith is hoping for something, believing what you can't see. I have faith all my life.
That was written by Adam Gettle. In the first, you know, 60 seconds, I was in tears. I mean, I went up to him at intermission and said, "Hi, my name is Bob Hurwitz, and I want to record this." He thought I was probably crazy because the show wasn't even going to Broadway. You know, his next show, which was Light in the Piazza, ended up winning 6 Tony Awards.
Bob Hurwitz, in our conversation last December, he's stepping down as president of Nonesuch Records at the end of this year. It's Here and Now.
Another blast of Arctic air put a deep freeze on much of the country yesterday. Dozens of record lows were recorded in the Midwest, and it dropped below zero as far south as Oklahoma and the Texas Panhandle. It was 37 degrees below zero in Aberdeen, South Dakota on Sunday morning, and 31 degrees below zero in Valentine, Kansas. Liz Miller, who owns the Covington Inn on the Mississippi River in St. Paul, Minnesota, says she's endured the cold just fine.
Twin City people are super hardy and strong. Like, I had friends that were out riding bikes today, riding their bikes, and there's like 10 inches of snow. And they just bundle up and we deal with it.
National Weather Service meteorologist Patrick Burke says another round of bad weather is coming just ahead of the busy holiday travel season.
Looking towards the travel dates right before Christmas, late this week into early next weekend, we could have a storm system developing over the western United States and the Rockies and then pulling out into the plain states. So you want to watch that for your travel plans.
And a reminder now that treacherous winter weather can turn tragic without warning. Two young hikers in New York State will be home for the holidays this year, but only after a close call. The couple went missing last week in the stormy, snowy Adirondack Mountains and spent two perilous nights lost in the bitter cold. Brian Mann from Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio has the story of the amazing rescue that brought them home.
Blake Aloy is age 20 and Madison Papalizio, age 19, vanished on a day hike to Algonquin, the second highest peak in the Adirondacks. With an Arctic storm blowing in, Forest Ranger Scott Van Laer was sent to search the dense forest near the summit. Imagine trying to find two lost hikers in a vast maze of snow.
We're going through the Krumholtz, which are, you know, 3, 4, 5 foot trees, and you get to all those air pockets, so you'll take a step and you'll crash through it. You're looking, you're yelling, but we're falling a lot, and you're exposed. It's the constant hitting of the wind.
So to give you a sense of what this situation was like for these two young people, I've skied into the high peaks in the valley below Algonquin here, and already I'm skiing through drifts of snow.
That sound is the creaking and popping of frozen trees hit by this fierce winter wind. Up high, where Aloyas and Papalizio were lost, it was much colder, the wind far more fierce. For 2 days, the searchers found nothing. By Tuesday morning, Ranger Scott Van Laer says he knew that had to be the day. One more night on the mountain in the cold and the dark, and their chances of survival were almost zero.
You don't give up. It does play a factor that it's someone so young. Definitely pulls at you emotionally more when it's young people. And I knew going in that day we had to get them within that window.
What no one knew was that the two hikers had mistakenly left the summit in the wrong direction, away from the trail. Madison Papalizio told CBS News that they fell, tumbling down a steep slope.
I was freezing. The fall pushed all of the snow up my jacket, into my gloves, in my boots.
She says they were too tired, too disoriented to fight their way back out.
We made an agreement early on when we got trapped that neither one of us could die. because we couldn't leave the other one alone.
Tuesday morning, Scott Van Laer's search crew finally caught a break. The wind and blowing snow had been so severe on the mountain that helicopters couldn't fly. But one chopper was finally able to bring supplies to a nearby base camp.
Both subjects heard the helicopter and yelled to it. And we happened to be 200 feet away from them. Extreme bit of luck.
Van Laer says the hikers were tucked down next to a tree out of the wind. The fact that they found some shelter kept them alive.
When we got down to them, I could see they were shivering dramatically. But given they're out for 2 days, that was a really good sign because their body is still compensating. You know, the heat mechanism is still working. They hadn't gone over to the edge where the body is not trying to heat them up anymore.
But they were too cold and weak to walk. With a howling wind and clouds swirling over the forest, a state police helicopter tried about a dozen times to lift the two hikers to safety. Lieutenant Peter McLean was the chopper pilot that day.
One of the rangers on the radio said, "We have a window. We have a small window here." The window that he was seeing wasn't as big as we would like it to be, but it was enough for us to get in.
A video shot by a member of the ground team shows the chopper just above the treetops, facing into the wind as the hikers are hoisted up. McLean says piloting the helicopter in those conditions was a roller coaster ride.
Was it hairy and dicey? Absolutely. If I never do another dramatic rescue again in my life, I'm good. You know, that was quite the drama.
On the video, you can hear Ranger Scott Van Laer cheer as the last hiker is pulled to safety.
Yes!
So they got them just before even worse Arctic weather blew in that would have certainly been fatal. Madison Papalizio is home safe. Blake Aloyas is still in hospital facing complications from severe frostbite, but he's alive and he'll be home soon. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Mann in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
A beautiful place to have such a frightening experience and an incredible story. The pictures are incredible as well. We've got images of this virtually impassable snowed-in terrain where rescuers found those hikers. We also have video of the airlift that you just heard at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young with Meghna Chakrabarty and for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.